This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Today, a proper look at the Africa Cup of Nations. We look back at the last 16, outfield players in goal, glorious free kicks, concussed goal scorers, penalty shootouts, officious refereeing, big upsets, all leaving us with a quarterfinal lineup to be played over the weekend. Also today, it's all okay. Gianni Infantino is going to fix the Mediterranean refugee crisis. Roy is confirmed at Watford. No one's confirmed at Everton, but lots of people are talking about it publicly, complaining about it publicly, and graffitiing about it publicly. Yet more Newcastle transfer gossip, and we have a musical finale. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hi, Max.
Jonathan Wilson, out in Douala in Cameroon. Hi, mate.
Morning, how you doing?
Very good, thank you very much. And a pod debut for Solis Chukwu, senior editor at Pulse Sports in Nigeria. Solis, how are you doing?
Doing very well, Max. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Recommended by our friend Arnu Adeyoye, who you may remember from the 2018 World Cup, who told us about the great over-the-bar chant that the Nigerian fans did when the opposition got a penalty. I think, Solis, is that I think with some success at that World Cup, I seem to remember.
Yeah, that panned out all right. More people should take that up, to be honest, all around the world. Let that be like Nigeria's legacy to the footballing world. So fans everywhere can just start chanting that whenever the opponent gets a penalty. That'll work.
Yeah, I'd love to see it in the Premier League. Now, Jonathan, we spoke briefly to Nick Ames on Tuesday in the aftermath of the tragic events in Cameroon after that game. What more do we know now?
Well, you spoke to Nick in Bafisam. He was at the next table in the hotel to me when he did that. And we then raced back to Yaoundé to try and find out a bit more. So it's about a five-hour drive from Bafisam to Yaoundé. We got back about 3 p.m., we went to the stadium, so it was, I guess, around about 3:30 when we got to the stadium. The tragedy happened between around about 8 and 8:30 the previous night. So we're talking, what's that, around about 18, 19 hours later when we were there. It's probably easiest to describe it in the way we sort of worked out what had happened, that the Alembe is right at the very, very far north edge of Yaoundé. So pretty much everybody going to the ground is coming from the south. The VIP entrance is to the west. It's not separate stand, it's a bowl, but it seems that pretty much everybody went towards that south stand. Now, there's some talk that in previous games, the entrances to the east and the north weren't open, and they were only open very late on Monday. I don't know if that's true, but that's what some people suggested. So you have maybe about 50 yards from the stadium, you have the turnstiles, as if it's a concourse. Coming out from the stadium, you've got concourse and the turnstiles, and you've got this avenue, which at that point is maybe about 100 yards wide. It sort of slightly widens out, going down a slight slope. So about 150 yards from the turnstiles, there is this fence. Now, that fence was only built at the end of November, and that, I think, is important. And then at that point, the avenue is maybe, I don't know, 100 yards wide, 120 yards wide. And beyond that, there were the tents where they were doing security, so checking bags, x-ray machines, that kind of thing. Beyond that, there was the COVID testing tents, and that's been done at every game. You go and you get a COVID test, and that's been done actually pretty efficiently. I don't think they wait the full 15 minutes, but they stick a swab up your nose, they do the test. So that I thought was going to cause chaos. That actually seems to be done pretty well. And then you go onto the roads in the city. So everybody was streaming up there. We saw video footage from around about 7:45 of fans running up there towards security, people climbing over that fence. Now, there are three gates in that fence, and it appears that two of them weren't open. And they had these sort of quite flimsy temporary barriers trying to funnel fans into tunnels. And from what we could make out, only the left hand of the three gate was open. So these temporary barriers, but certainly between the central section and the left-hand section, had been knocked down, and they were still there on Tuesday when we got there. They'd clearly been trampled on. They were sort of buckled over the curb. But some kind of cleanup had gone on, but still around that left-hand gate, there was loads of shards of broken brother's ailers. We saw a sandal, a shoe, a couple of pairs of broken glasses. The advertising banners, some of them had been pulled off the fences. Patrice Motsepe, the president of CAF, he's spoken about this gate being inexplicably closed. And I think that is the direct cause. So we then went to the Misasi Hospital, which is where there's a triage center set up at the stadium. Then victims were taken from there to the Misasi Hospital. We spoke to a security guard there who said he'd been on night duty the night before, and by 4 a.m., everybody had been moved from there to specialist units around the city, one of which is called CUI, the Centre des Urgences de Yaoundé, so the Yaoundé Emergency Centre. So we went there and we spoke to a doctor, and she said six people had been brought in the previous night, and this is a hospital for serious cases. I think she said eight people had been brought, two of them they said weren't serious enough to bother with CUI, so they were moved on elsewhere. So the six they took in, two had been released the next morning. She said all of them showed signs of having been trampled upon. So it wasn't that they were crushed against the fences, they were knocked down and then people stood on them. Four of them had been kept in, one of them had already gone when we got there, one of them was just being discharged when we got there. The two who were left, one was a 20-year-old man, and his case seems to have been slightly different. He was in that south section of the stand, which I think was overfilled. And what he said was when Aboubakar scored the second goal, as he was celebrating, he felt the pressure on his chest and collapsed, and he was then trampled on. Now, we know that the triage centre at the hospital, he was unconscious for between 45 minutes and an hour, so presumably been unconscious for some time before that. What I don't know is whether his collapse was caused by the crush or whether that was a pre-existing condition, and he was then trampled on, which obviously makes things much worse. The other man, though, is called Salomon. He said he got there just before 8, then around about 8:14, 8:15, there'd been this surge towards the gate, and that's when he'd been knocked down and trampled on. So that appears to be what happened. Now, the point with this fence is that back in November, CAF said to the local organising committee, we can't use the Alembe unless you complete the external works, which included that fence and the road just outside it, which is where people were trampled. Now, that sounds like the building of a fence has caused the tragedy. I think that's too simple a conclusion, because I think if that fence hadn't been there, all he would have done was move the situation 150 yards up that avenue to actually slightly tighter bottleneck near the stadium. So I think actually, and yeah, this is me as an absolute non-specialist in this, trying to logically work out what went on. The issue is there should have been a previous perimeter fence, which should have slowed the ingress of people onto that avenue. And that wasn't built, but it was in initial plans. And also this issue of, were the gates in the east stand and the north stand open? Now, we spoke to somebody who said that as he'd approached with his fiance at around 10 to 8, he'd seen it was really busy, and a policeman had directed him round to the east stand where he got in. So he was saying people just wanted to go to the nearest entrance. But there is this suggestion that previous games, those other entrances weren't open. The guy who said he'd been moved round to the east side, he also said the police were significantly outnumbered, which for that time in Cameroon, where there's police and gendarmerie everywhere, is extraordinary.
Solis, I wonder what you think the impact of this has had on the whole tournament.
Really, it's a real downer on the mood at the AFCON, to be honest. We all remember coming into the tournament, there were a lot of concerns about whether or not Cameroon could actually do this. Famously, the thing was moved from 2019 when they should have hosted it up till now. So yeah, it's just sort of resurrected those doubts that people had, you know, from the start, whether or not Cameroon were actually ready. I remember at the time there were a lot of there was a lot of skepticism, and it's almost like Cameroon employed this media offensive against any kinds of criticism, especially online, against people talking about the state of things in Cameroon and the state of hotels and stuff. But no one really thought it would be a stadium issue. Everyone just thought maybe security with the insurgents, you know, up north, or maybe the hotels and the accommodations. But, you know, a tragedy like this, it's murder on the tournament, to be honest. And it's made worse by the fact that it doesn't seem like the CAF leadership handled this as well as they could. There were a lot of calls for the games, games on the following day to be postponed and stuff. And, you know, more empathetic gestures from CAF toward the people who died and those who were in hospital, but that didn't materialize. So it's really sad, to be honest.
Wilson, I wonder if you sensed that an idea of postponing games or even further.
I don't think that was ever considered. I understand that. I mean, it's in 2010 in Angola, when the press officer and two others on the Togo team bus were shot and killed, which was what, 3 days, 4 days before the tournament started. The tournament went on then. In Mali in 2002, when four people were killed in the celebrations after Mali got a draw against Nigeria, the tournament went on. I certainly haven't felt among Cameroonians any sense, any consideration that the tournament should stop. You know, this is a tournament they've been waiting for 50 years. The last time it hosted was 1972. And as one of the great giants of African football, they've been desperate to have it. And I think in many ways, the tournament has been relatively well organized. I was sort of, having heard all the stories before, and I was expecting worse. Now, Douala is chaos. In the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter, but the media facilities in Douala are nonsense. You know, they're not. It's the worst media facilities I've found in the Cup of Nations since 2008. But in Bafoussam, it's really, really good. I haven't been to a game in Yaounde yet. We'll find out the weekend. And the other thing that's clearly true here that makes it different to other Cups of Nations is that games not involving the hosts are still followed incredibly closely. You walk down the street when there's a game on, and there are hundreds and hundreds of people watching the games on TV. You can hear the radio commentary being boomed out of loudspeakers. People are talking about it. And to be honest, that doesn't really happen, doesn't happen at every Cup of Nations. There's a massive enthusiasm for football here that I just haven't really experienced at a Cup of Nations before. And I guess that in a tragic way is a contributory factor towards the tragedy that too many people wanted to be at that game.
Jonathan, do you know if there was an awareness in the stadium or on the pitch of what was happening outside when it was happening?
Well, okay, journalists say that they found out, or they first got wind of it midway through the second half. So we're talking probably an hour, just over an hour after it happened. And so I spoke to a couple of journalists who went outside to see what was going on, and they said they saw sort of a heap of shoes, probably 4 or 5 dozen shoes by that gate. So it wasn't immediately clear. So they knew then, I think, in terms of fans, in terms of players, not a clue. So the fan I talked to, who was there with his fiance, who went around to the east side of the stadium, he's actually an emergency doctor. And he was saying that he wished he had known, because he could have gone and helped. But he didn't find out until he got home that night and put the radio on. Even leaving the ground, there was nothing to suggest to him anything untoward had happened. So I think they must have done some kind of clear up pretty quickly. Now, I've seen photographs of 7 of the bodies lying on the ground in what appears to be some kind of tent or triage centre at the stadium. Sorry. And so I presume they were moved there pretty soon after it happened. Of those 7 victims, 2 were women, 2 were kids. I think we now know one was 14, one was 6. One of those bodies was a man wearing a white vest, and you can see footprints on the vest, which is A, horrific, but B, it does confirm that suggestion that trampling was the major cause of it.
A CAF statement says they're aware of the incident that took place at the Elembe Stadium during the Total Energies Africa Cup of Nations fixture between Cameroon and Comoros on the 24th of January. CAF is currently investigating the situation, trying to get more details on what transpired. We're in constant communication with Cameroon government and the local organising committee. We'll be back in just a second. I know I say this lots of times on this podcast, whenever we talk about something serious, it seems very trite to go from that to talking about football matches. But I guess that's what this podcast is, and that's what we'll do next. Welcome to part 2 of the Guardian Football Weekly. On the pitch, that Cameroon-Comoros game, Solis, was extraordinary, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, when you consider all of the stuff that, you know, led up to it, and Comoros having a number of players out with COVID, you know, most pertinently their goalkeepers, and at the end of the day, they ended up having to field their reserve left back in goal, which was Tremendous, tremendous storyline, really, when you think about it. But the way the match played out at the end of the day, the game sort of descended into a bit of a farce, to be honest. And it was, at the end of the day, it was the goalkeeper, the goalkeeper who wasn't a goalkeeper, who, you know, took a lot of the plaudits for what was not a very good game, quality-wise, to be honest. A lot of people expected that with Comoros having their goalkeeper situation and all that, that Cameroon would just steamroll at them. But it seemed like it almost threw Cameroon off because they had like no ideas what to do. Like, they were just really slow, and you know, the attacking was seriously lacking any kind of initiative or coordination. And you know, a lot of people were just like, okay, this guy is not a goalkeeper. You know, take a shot from like 40 yards or something. Try a lob. Do something really elaborate and, you know, let's test him out. But Cameroon didn't get a shot on target in that game until probably the second half or something silly like that. Apart from the goal, of course, their second shot on target was like in the 48th or 47th minute or something. So it just really showed Cameroon have not looked particularly impressive at this AFCON, to be honest. And that game was just, everything came to a head. And at the end of the day, it was Comoros who ended up looking the more impressive side, I think, with their patient possession play and, you know, exploiting spaces, even though they went down to 10 men really early.
Barry, I mean, outfield players going in goal is one of the greatest things in football. And Al Hadour, who I confess I was not aware of before this game, I mean, his saves were unconventional, but he made quite a lot of good saves, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Solas that in terms of quality, the game was poor, but because of the many subplots, and I do appreciate, as you said, Max, this is very much, anyway, Mrs. Lincoln, what did you think of the play territory when we, you know, now that we know what was going on outside? But it was tremendously entertaining because that your man in goals, Chaker Al Hadour, it was the Cameroonian goalkeeper who looked a little more dodgy, to be honest. And he's an actual goalkeeper, Andre Ananu, who almost gave away an early goal by parrying the ball into the path of a Comoros striker when there was no need for him to do that at all. The shot he was saving was going wide. Then you Jimmy Abdou getting sent off after 8 minutes. And you really feared for Comoros at that point. You know, I thought they could lose by 12, 15, 20 goals, 10 men, no goalkeeper. And for them to be still in contention with 10 minutes to go was just incredible, absolutely incredible. And you could see Cameroon were really nervous because if they had messed that up, it would have been one of the greatest upsets, not just in African football history, but in football history. That Chaker Al Hadour, who went in goal for Comoros, deserves every credit. He clearly, you know, you could tell by looking at him, he wasn't a goalkeeper. The first goal scored by Tokwin Kambi, he didn't even attempt to dive for it, whereas a proper goalkeeper almost certainly would have saved. But he pulled off some good saves, which were simultaneously terrible saves.
Wilson, also, the free kick for Comoros from Youssef Changama is absolutely ridiculous, isn't it?
Oh, I mean, how far was he? 40 yards? It was ludicrous. And right in the top corner. There's no, I mean, I take Barry's point that Nana didn't have his most convincing game. And I think he is still feeling his way back after that drugs ban, which I think we mentioned before. Sid did the interview with him. It seems he was pretty unfortunate that he inadvertently took one of his wife's diuretics rather than a paracetamol. But yeah, he could have been in the best form of his life and he wouldn't have saved that. It was an inch under the bar, an inch inside the post, and going at great pace and dipping really sharply.
Cameroon didn't look great in this game, but I mean, they've got home advantage. Do you see them as favourites or not? Or does that game make you think they're not going to make it?
I mean, it's tournament football. Cameroon won in 2017, and I remember early in the tournament, they didn't look that great. But then they sort of like grew into it and as the tournament went on and got better and better. So the fact that they have home advantage this time, and when you consider their stature in African football, you have to think of them as favorites. But their play generally has not been has not been. There's been aspects of it that are great. I think their pressing is really good and stuff. But in terms of how they want to attack, I think they're sort of caught between two stools a bit. The system they use against Comoros, you know, when they brought Triple Morton into the lineup as a number 10, that helps them a little bit when they attack, but they're a little less secure defensively. So it's almost like a Goldilocks situation. When they play their usual 4-3-3, they're too defensive. When they play the 4-2-3-1, they're too attacking. And they've not quite found, you know, the middle ground there, I think. So it's hard to say, really.
Senegal 2, Cape Verde 0. Big talking point from this game is Sadio Mane clashed heads with the Cape Verde keeper, Vozinha, who was sent off after the VAR consultation. Mane scored. Then he went off with concussion. Alex says, Baz, Sadio Mane, high horse, go.
Yeah, he shouldn't have been allowed to play on. He was clearly knocked out. He was clearly concussed. Everyone in Europe, I think, well, everyone in England anyway, loves to have a pop at AFCON. And there is a concern that this tournament is going to be remembered for the tragedy of Lembe Stadium, empty stadiums, a ref blowing up early, Comoros being forced to play an outfield keeper in goal, a bloke being hit by the stretcher trolley, you know, the kind of things we here like to laugh at. That things that could happen at any other tournament. But the quality of the football in this tournament has been outstanding at times. But this is another stick with which people who don't like AFCON can use to beat it. And you don't have to go to Africa to see players being left on when they shouldn't, when they're clearly concussed. My understanding is there aren't concussion subs allowed in this tournament, but, you know, they're allowed in the Premier League and people very rarely take advantage of them. And it will be interesting to see if Sadio Mane is selected to play for Senegal in their quarterfinal against Equatorial Guinea, because he shouldn't be. He should be stood down for at least a week, you'd think. And I suspect he almost certainly will be selected.
It was interesting, Wilson, the keeper was sent off. I think it was the right decision, but quite often you see, you know, for example, David Luiz and Raul Jimenez in that game, you know, your head is still a part of your body and you can foul somebody with it.
Yes, that's true. And I think keepers generally get away with things they probably shouldn't. You think Manuel Neuer on Gonzalo Higuain in the 2014 World Cup final, which for me was an obvious red card. You know, he clattered into it, but somehow because he's a keeper, he gets away with it. So I don't know. I think there's been a lot of harsh red cards in this last 16. I felt that was sort of on the redder side of orange, if that makes sense. So you're right. You can't be reckless going in with your head just because it's your head, not your foot. That is true. I think from Senegal's point of view, the greater worry is how lacking in creativity they appear. I mean, they scored three goals in the tournament, two of them against nine-man Cape Verde, and the other one a very, very late penalty against Zimbabwe, which was one of those, you know, long-range shot, hit somebody's hand. Could he get out of the way? Probably not. Is it a penalty? Well, maybe, maybe not. So despite, you know, all the attacking talent they've got on that side, they're really not quite clicking yet.
Burkina Faso drew with Gabon. They went through on penalties. It was far more entertaining than Chelsea-Spurs that was happening at exactly the same time. I was a big fan of Gabon trying to score from kickoff. And the big takeaway from this game, Solis, was Bertrand Traoré of Villa, who missed a penalty, gave Burkina Faso the lead, plays right up front for them. So he plays much more advanced than he does for Aston Villa and had a brilliant game, didn't he?
Yeah, in terms of like what he was able to do, yeah, it was really brilliant. But the actual performance, I think, was very much a mixed bag. I made a statement on Twitter, I think. I said if you like plotted his performance on a graph, it would be like an EKG. It would just, up, down. There were moments of great quality and then there were just some ridiculous things along the way. So I think that's kind of the package you get with Bertrand Traoré. Like that penalty miss was one of those like cosmic justice moments, because I think the decision was a nonsense to begin with. So it was him missing it was, yeah, you know, good on you. You righted that wrong from the referee, but then he took the goal really well. And then, you know, it just had a sublime mix with the ridiculous sort of game for the rest of it. And yeah, it was a really, really entertaining game. I came away from this tournament with a very, you know, huge, high impression of Gabon. I think considering all the turmoil that was in their camp coming in and, you know, the problems with bonus payments from the FA and losing Aubameyang and Lamina and COVID and stuff, I thought they gave some very good performances at this AFCON, better than I've seen from them in a long time.
I loved there was one angle of the Traore finish where it looked like a kind of Phil Mickelson putt. It was just going so slowly and just sort of just absolutely, you know, it hit the brake at the perfect time and just rolled in off the post. I mean, you talked about unlucky red cards. I can't remember the red card in this. Oh, no, the red card was, Wilson, was it sort of, I think it was a shirt pull in this one, wasn't it? Second yellow.
Well, it was more that the ref gave like 15 yellows in the game.
Yeah,
and it just seemed a dirty game. I mean, he seemed to give the Gabon keeper a yellow for jumping about a bit on his line during the penalty shootout, which I had no idea what that was for. So you just sort of knew there's a red card coming, because if you're giving out a yellow card every 6 minutes, I think that maths is right, is it? 120 divided by 15 is...
Eight,
yeah, thank you. If you're giving out a yellow card every 8 minutes, eventually somebody's gonna collect two. Yeah, I thought the ref slightly spoiled that game. And of course, the other thing with Burkina Faso, there's been a coup in Burkina Faso this week. The military seizing power and the president in detention. So I've got no idea how that's going to affect the squad, but it's obviously something else going on there.
That was incredibly quick maths, Solis. Is that a skill that you have?
That's what I do in my spare time. I just think of random numbers and start multiplying and dividing them. So that's like a hobby I have, yeah.
I'm afraid, Solis, we have to move on to Nigeria's defeat.
Oh, boy.
To Tunisia. How are you?
I think I took it better than most people, because I was actually, you know, one of the people who... through Nigeria's, you know, perfect group stage campaign in terms of points was constantly saying, yeah, this team has a lot of issues. It's not all set up. I thought the first game, Egypt were really, really poor, both from a tactical perspective and in terms of what they were trying to do. Although I had no idea what Kero's plan of attack was. And obviously we've seen Egypt go through the tournament now, but that performance seemed to give people the wrong impression. Here in Nigeria, we have this mental hang-up with... We like to hark back to the 94 team, the golden generation, and how they played. And for many people, how they played is the way to play, you know? You know, you play the 4-4-2 with the wide wingers and you hit them all the time and let them dribble one-on-one and put crosses in. But it's 2022. That really won't cut it anymore. There are so many more avenues to shut off that sort of thing. And Nigerians just mentally seem to be stuck with that. So... when they saw this Nigeria side, you know, getting it wide, the wingers dribbling, putting it into the box, it was like, yay, you know. But, you know, that was bound to come unstuck at some point. And Tunisia had the tools to do that. And they pulled that off on the day in, I think, very easy fashion. I don't think they even had to get out of first gear or anything.
I didn't see this game, Max, but I just as soon as I saw the result, I had a little chuckle at how confident Nedum had been about Nigeria's chances on his last appearance.
You're absolutely right.
Sorry, Solis, can I just ask, what's happening with the managerial situation? Is Augustin Agbayan definitely out, or is he going to be in charge for the World Cup qualifier against Ghana, or what's happening there?
The thing is, no one knows, not even the FA. They have no idea what to do at this point, because before the AFCON, they were like, okay, Agbayan, you're the technical director, but you take charge of the team at the AFCON. And then they appointed... Jose Peseiro, who's a Portuguese guy, former coach of Braga and Sporting Lisbon, whatever. So they appointed him and they said he would be in Cameroon in sort of like a supervisory capacity and then take over right after. But then it turns out that it's not even really clear whether a contract has actually been signed with Peseiro, because, you know, I don't know, Jonathan, if you know the Nigerian FA president, Amaju Pinnick, he's a real, you know, he likes to beat his own drum a little bit. So
yeah, I'm sort of aware of his reputation rather than knowing him, but yeah.
It turns out that it seems that has not been signed and Peseiro was not actually in Cameroon. So no one knows now if, you know, obviously Nigeria crashing out, if you're Peseiro, you are asking for more money at this point, because, hey, look at this, look at what I have to work with, right? So Egwavon, after the team crashed out to Tunisia, he kind of came out and said, okay, yeah, I still have my job as technical director and I'll keep doing that, and then the FA can decide whatever they want to do. So no one knows at this point whether Egwavon will stay for the World Cup playoffs. But the obvious question is, if you sack him and you bring in a new manager for that and he loses that against Ghana, there is no way you can keep him, because it's Ghana. You don't lose to Ghana in Nigeria. That's unheard of. Like, they will slaughter you in the streets. So if that's your first thing you do as Nigeria coach, it's going to be a really rough sailing from there. So we've gotten ourselves in a real bind, Nigeria, but that's what we do. So, yeah.
Well, the beautiful thing about this in terms of just narratives is that Egwavon was coach in, what, 2007?
Yeah.
And then 2006-7, yeah. And then his final game before he was replaced by Bertie Vogts was against Ghana,
yeah,
which is a game played at Griffin Park at Brentford, yeah, which
horrific
I was there.
Game. Horrific.
Well, yeah, so Nigeria hadn't lost to Ghana in 17 years, and they got beat 4-1 that night. And am I right in saying Nigeria haven't beaten Ghana in a competitive game since? Is that true?
Yeah, that's correct.
So that was the real turning point. And so that press conference afterwards, Egwavon got absolutely monstered by the Nigerian press. And if you think sort of the English tabloids are bad, the Nigerian tabloids are significantly more aggressive.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was 15 minutes of absolute slaughter. And Claude Dewa, who was the great old French coach, who's coached every team in Africa at least 15 times.
And Cambridge United
And Cambridge United, of course, yeah, yeah. He was actually sitting three seats long from me last night, Claude Lewis, because he's just always here. He's just always about. It doesn't matter where you are.
Yeah.
In a couple of nations, are never more than 20 feet from a Claude Lewis. but he was the Ghana coach. And so there's this absolutely brutal press conference. And as it finishes, he says, look, I understand that everybody's very upset by the results, but I think we should understand that today is Mr. Egwavon's birthday, so can we all sing happy birthday to him?
Oh, no.
So Claude Lewa sings leads his entire press room singing happy birthday to Augustin Egwavon as his final act as Nigeria coach.
Oh, right.
And that's where we'll end part two. We'll finish off the rest of the round of 16 and do the news from closer to home as well, just a second. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Mali 0, Equatorial Guinea 0. Equatorial Guinea through 6-5 on penalties. Lots of tears, Solace, at the end of this game. It was it's a wonderful result for Equatorial Guinea, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Equatorial Guinea. This is really a landmark tournament for them, because the two previous occasions they've qualified for the AFCON, they've been hosting it in some capacity. So this is almost like a third debut for them, in a way, and they've come this far, and it's really impressive. I thought Mali have every right to feel disappointed, because they were one of the dark horses for this tournament coming in. I mean, they have such a great squad, and in qualifying they did really well, almost perfect. So coming in here, a lot of people expected much from them, but we just saw on the night a lot of the stuff that has dogged Mali through the tournament. Their possession play is really good, they counter press really well, but they just can't score goals. You know, everything is fine until it gets to the opposing penalty area. And, you know, against an Equatorial Guinea side who defend their box really well, Mali just found it really tough going. And Equatorial Guinea managed to shut the game down, got a couple of breaks on the counter, which is what they do. But at the end of the day, once it went to penalties, you just knew Mali were going to lose it somehow.
The other game that finished goalless was Ivory Coast Egypt. Egypt went through 5-4 on penalties. Mo Salah with a decisive penalty. Eric Bailly with the decisive miss. You were there, Wilson.
Yeah, Eric Bailly actually had a really, really, really good game. And then for some reason tried ludicrous dink penalty, which when they don't come off always look terrible. But he was man of the match until that moment. Bringing the ball out from the back was one brilliant disguised shot when he unslipped it through to Sebastien Haller, who unfortunately also been taken in by the disguised shot and was ducking out of the way, and the ball sort of just trickled past him to the keeper. But it was I don't want to be too critical, because the pitch in Douala is awful, but Egypt's shooting is just terrible, and Cote d'Ivoire's crossing is terrible. And if either of those two things had been slightly less terrible, then that side would have won quite easily. So I think the issue for Egypt is they've only scored two goals in four games. Now, I know that's how Carlos Queiroz tends to play. I know he likes to control games. That's been true since he was coaching Portugal's under-20 side 30 years ago. But you do look at that forward line with Salah and Mamouche and Mustafa Mohamed, and you sort of think they should be a bit more creative, a bit more inventive than that. But then you also think, you know, if they finished a couple of chances, they'd have won that quite easily. And we just said, yeah, that they played it really well. And I think what was impressive from Chaos's point of view was in the beginning of the second half. I mean, Ivory Coast, I thought, began the better. And then when Kessié went off after half an hour, Egypt started to take control.
Yeah, that really rocked them.
Yeah, but then beginning of the second half, Cote d'Ivoire came back into it. And the game became quite end-to-end, and Chaos changed shape from 4-3-3 to 4-3-1, closed it down, and he seemed quite happy to go to penalties. And that's three times now since 1998 that Cote d'Ivoire have drawn 0-0 with Egypt and then lost on penalties. So from Chaos's point of view, I guess he got it right in that he shut the opponent, but it was a slightly odd game that it was... And I think that's largely due to the pitch. I think we'll see the measure of Egypt on Sunday when they get to Yaounde.
Morocco 2, Malawi 1. Ghani says, I'd love to hear Barry describing this rocket. He's talking about Gabadinho Mango's opener for Malawi, Baz. What a hit that was.
It is one of the best goals I've ever seen. I think yesterday was the 25th anniversary of Trevor Sinclair's bicycle kick.
It was.
Which is also one of the best goals I've ever seen. Two completely different strikes, but this was quite remarkable. Utterly unstoppable. I think the Morocco goalkeeper got a finger to it, couldn't keep it out. And yeah, it was a remarkable strike of a football. Incredible. And unfortunately for the scorer, his team didn't go on to win the game.
No. I mean, I was sort of maybe being slightly harsh by questioning where the goalkeeper's standing, but it's such a brilliant hit, isn't it? I mean, Hakimi's free kick as well, Solis, was stunning, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's not many games you get two absolute stuns like that. If you want to be hypercritical about the Malawi goal, I was in the moment, but then I watched it again. And I mean, if you're a goalkeeper, you just don't expect the striker's shoot from there. It was ludicrous, really, that you think Gabadinho Mwanga would shoot from that distance. So you kind of cut him some slack. And I'm a big fan of Achraf Hakimi, and even more so now that he seems to have suddenly decided he can take free kicks. I mean, he's already a player who can do pretty much everything, has great athleticism, great in tight spaces, one of the best right backs in the world. And then suddenly he just rocks up at AFCON and says, hey, okay, I fancy a free kick now. And he scored two. So that's Achraf Hakimi for you. These young players, they keep surprising you. Yeah.
Hakimi, he's the first player to score two direct free kicks in a couple of nations since right. Jeremy in 2002.
And he went close with another one in that game as
well. Yeah, he did.
Did Jeremy score more than two, Wilson, or would that be him out on his own?
No, nobody ever scored more than two goals in Mali, where the pitches were universally terrible.
And the heat. Oh, God, the heat.
Let's talk about Gambia's win against Guinea. You were there, Wilson.
Well, not only was I there, but I think, I hate to talk about my method. But I think you really have to immerse yourself into the experience of a tournament. So I went with Nick Ames on Sunday to the Gambia team hotel, and we spoke to two Gambia players. We spoke to Omar Colley, the centre back, and we spoke to Abima Dabo, who I think is a really interesting figure. You know, he's at Roma now, and he when he was 14 or 15, he left Gambia, made his way to Libya, obviously by land. Pretty horrendous things happened to him in Libya. He then managed to get on a boat to Italy, and he's now playing football in Serie A and being coached by Jose Mourinho, and so his story is incredible. Which, when you heard what Gianni Infantino said yesterday about refugees crossing the Mediterranean, you sort of think, well, there is a great refugee crossing the Mediterranean story going on right now, and it's not Infantino. But the Gambians were incredibly friendly, incredibly hospitable. And while they were having their lunch, they got us plates of food from a buffet and gave it to us. Now, you may have noted the two Gambian fullbacks both had to pull out of the game in the hour before kickoff, having been named in the team sheet because of food poisoning. I too have had that food poisoning. And I think if you're going to football matches as a journalist and you're not getting the same diseases off the food that the players are, you're not doing your job properly. Now, the good news is that things are slightly more reliable on the stool front over the last 24 hours.
Oh, good to know.
And so I think we can expect both those Gambians to be back in action at the weekend.
That's what we want to know when people tune in. They want to know, is Wilson passing solid stools? Well, now we have... yes, Barry, your hand is up.
I just wanted to ask, I mean, Gambia are the lowest ranked team in the tournament. I think their FIFA ranking is 150. And that their coach has been complaining about the fact that they've been forced, that in their accommodation, they've been forced to sleep. Not only is the food dodgy, they've been forced to sleep 4 to 6 in a room, which seems remarkable at the best of times, but during with COVID, you know, seems just bizarre. But he said, or insinuated, it's because they're minnows, that they're being treated shabbily. But can you put him in context, Jonathan, or Solace? What would the European equivalent of, you know, was this like Northern Ireland getting to the last 8 or something like that?
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, I think we, to address the issue of the accommodation and everything, look, the hotel is certainly from the outside, it's a really lovely hotel. But they the two players we spoke to, Colley and Darbo, were both complaining about this issue of them having to share rooms, and in some cases up to 4 to 6 to a room. Now, CAF have denied that. CAF say that's not true. So that's really odd that Sanfiat, the coach, has said that. These two players have said that. So CAF are lying, or they've decided to come up with this story to kind of create some underdog. I mean, who knows? But... clearly, there's an issue with the food. I established that all too reliably. Colley's, you know, he's a centre back. He's a big guy, and he was saying that where they stayed near Limbe in the group stage, when he got there, the bed was so small he had to ask them for a separate mattress. He could put the mattress on the floor and sleep on that. And the Gambian FA then stepped in and moved him to better accommodation. So there's been some issue there, whether that's the Gambian FA issue, whether that's a local organising committee issue, whether that's a CAF issue, I don't know. But yeah, there have been complaints. Yeah, you know, we were asking them about why has this happened? Why has there been this surge? And the 6 of them now play in Italy. There's others playing at European clubs. So I think what's happened is they just got a critical mass who have got big clubs, and so they're playing top level football on a regular basis. And Colley is, I think he's 29 now. And he played when they won the under-17 Cup of Nations 12 years ago, I guess, whenever that was. And Gambia's record in youth football is pretty good, certainly for the size of the country. But what he was saying was that a lot of those players end up falling out of the game because they just don't get the opportunity. The scouts don't go to Gambia, so those players don't get the chance to play at bigger clubs, so it's very hard for them to develop or even just to make a living out of it. And he thinks that now that there are a significant number of Gambians in Europe, that will increase opportunities, and that will A, be an inspiration to other young Gambians, but also will encourage European clubs to look to Gambia when they're looking to sign players.
The manager, Sanfiet, you say Tom Sanfiet, has managed a lot of countries. Namibia, Zimbabwe, Ethiopia, Yemen, Malawi, Togo, Bangladesh, Trinidad and Tobago, Malta, and Gambia. Sort of wondered about his life. It's a very curious, hard to really sort of settle down, make roots and forge.
But he's only, was he 48 or 49?
He doesn't look it at all. He looks ancient.
He looks like one of the hairy bikers. That was all I could think of when he came over to talk to us.
It's cookies and bangers and mash and just go on a motorbike tour. What if he's done a motorbike tour through those countries? Make quite a good travel doc. Right, we've got Gambia, Cameroon, Burkina Faso, Tunisia on Saturday, Egypt, Morocco, and Senegal, Equatorial Guinea on Sunday. Solis, who's winning? Who's winning AFCON for you?
Oh, okay. You just threw me a hot potato there. Okay. I want to say Morocco because I think they've been the most impressive side at the AFCON. But you know, this whole thing about North African teams generally not winning AFCONs in West Africa and stuff, of West and Central Africa. So that's really the only thing I can throw in front of them as an obstacle. But I think in terms of their play on the pitch, they've been really good. If they get past Egypt, you know, which is kind of like it's a North African derby, and that's a really difficult game for them traditionally in African football. If they get past Egypt, I think you'd have to think of them as the favourites, to be honest.
Wilson, where are you going?
Yeah, boringly, I agree with that entirely. I think that quarterfinal should be the highest quality of the four quarters. I think it's pretty hard to assess Egypt just because they're playing up in Garua than playing in Douala. I think the pitches in Yaounde are better. So we'll see the measure of Egypt against Morocco, and I think whoever wins that, unless they end up sort of physically or emotionally exhausted by that game, probably should be favoured. But Cameroon, home advantage, and Francois Aboubakar is scoring goals, which is a big help when so many forwards are missing goals this tournament. I mean, Senegal still have the best players, but yeah, they just played appallingly so far. We don't know if Sadio Mane is going to be able to play. So,
Andy says, in an incredibly condescending speech, Gianni Infantino claimed that a World Cup every 2 years could fix the Mediterranean refugee crisis. What's the worst claim the panel has made to justify something that no one else wanted? He was speaking at a session of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, a transnational body dedicated to the support of human rights. Infantino said that countries outside Europe need greater access to national football competitions to prevent drastic consequences. He said, this topic is not about whether we want a World Cup every 2 years, but about what do we want for the future of football. If we think about the rest of the world and the vast majority of Europe, then we have to think about what football brings. Football's about opportunity, about hope, about the national teams. We cannot say to the rest of the world, give us your money, but watch us on TV. We need to include them. We need to find ways to include the whole world to give hope to Africans so they don't need to cross the Mediterranean in order to find maybe a better life, but more probably death in the sea. Later, he said his remarks had been misinterpreted. I wish to clarify that in my speech, my more general message was that everyone in a decision-making position has a responsibility to help improve the situation of people around the world. Solis, we have obviously a very sort of Eurocentric view of Infantino and what he's trying to do. Obviously, you can't speak for the whole of Nigeria, let alone the whole of Africa. But I just wonder, what is the general sense of him as the head of FIFA where you are?
Oh, we can't stand him, to be honest.
Good.
I think the thing there is, Africans are generally very resistant to the idea of someone coming in and, you know, telling us what to do and how to run our football, and that seems to be almost his entire remit as FIFA president. You know, he has Fatma Samora running things here. He has Veron Musengo Omba running things here, so we're pretty much sick of him at this point. So whenever he sticks his foot in his mouth, we have this sort of war between people who are loyal to, you know, the CAF hierarchy and everything, and then we all go to war on WhatsApp forums and everything, going back and forth at each other, and you know, it's really crazy. But in terms of Infantino, he's really not very liked in Africa, you know, apart from the people who benefit, which is the, you know, the people he put in there in CAF anyway. So yeah, it's just we're used to these moments from Infantino at this point. No one really cares about him.
And in terms of a World Cup every 2 years, I mean, that I would say in Europe is sort of universally detested as an idea. What's the view in Africa?
We're not on board with that at all either here, because I mean, if you're pitching it as African countries get more chances to host, if that's your angle, I don't think very many African countries actually want to host the World Cup, to be honest. I mean, it was really cool that it came to South Africa and it was a real historic moment, but South Africa themselves, they're still dealing with the impact from that, what with white elephant stadiums all over the place, and you know, the sheer cost of it. It's not something that very many African countries can take on. So that carrot really doesn't work for us. It's just one of those things that it's populist, and you know, CAF is being run by FIFA anyway, so they made it so that, you know, if it comes to voting, they have a whole block of votes from Africa, but the actual people on the ground and the people who want their voices heard are not on board with the two biennial World Cup at all.
Moving to the Premier League, Roy Hodgson is back, confirmed as Watford manager. Mr. Lancaster says, do all those that put in Roy Hodgson's retirement whip round, are they entitled to a refund? I hate office rejoiners. Stick a tenner in the card and they're back inside 2 years. The club have not announced the length of Hodgson's contract. I'm not that that necessarily matters at Watford. It's not something that we ever tend to find out. Richard Jolly's a couple of good stats. Roy Hodgson is the sixth man to manage Watford since they kept a Premier League clean sheet. And the Pozzos have made 15 permanent managerial appointments at Watford, whereas only 14 people have ever been recognised as the Dalai Lama. The first one was born in 1391.
How does Richard Jolly come up with these things?
It's extraordinary, isn't it? And meanwhile, in Everton news, Frank Lampard versus Vitor Pereira. Pereira looked set to take the Everton job, but the Daily Mail is reporting that due to fan protests, he's considering pulling out. He was sacked by Fenerbahce in December, has been approached three times previously by Everton. He's done well to dodge that bullet three times. Graffiti appeared on Goodison, Goodison with Pereira out, Lampard in. And then Pereira, this question from Max says, have you ever called up a media outlet after a job interview to explain to the masses why you'd feel you'd be suitable for the job? Yes, he went on Sky Sports News, Barry, to tell everybody about the interview he'd just had. I mean, it's a funny situation, isn't it?
I haven't seen the interview. I wasn't aware of that, but I did see the graffiti, which I presume Frank Lampard sprayed on the wall in question. If Pereira does end up getting the job, it couldn't really have got off to a worse start when he's defending himself before he's even been offered it. I don't know much about him. I know he's won titles in three different countries. And he, yeah, as you say, has been approached by Everton before. He turned them down, I think, in 2019 when he was in China managing Shanghai. But it looks like they'll probably give it to Frank Lampard. Whether or not, you know, who has far more fans in the British media than Pereira, whether or not that will be a wise decision, only time will tell. But I don't think Lampard has done much in his fledgling managerial career to date. I would have no objection to him getting the job, and I'd be interested to see if it goes pear-shaped for him, which it probably will.
Newcastle fans getting very excited about transfers. Manchester United are asking for a huge loan fee for Jesse Lingard. That may not happen. Bruno Guimaraes, lots of outlets reported that this deal was very close yesterday morning. Lyon then released a statement saying Olympique Lyonnais categorically denies the false information disseminated by many media reporting an agreement between Newcastle and us for the transfer of Bruno Guimaraes. We're going to do a transfer. We're going to wait for the deadline to close on Tuesday and then do a pod on Wednesday with all the transfers that have happened.
A lot of Newcastle fans seem really surprised that other clubs are trying to rinse them for extortionate amounts of money, and seem quite affronted by the fact that Manchester United, it's rumoured they were asking for a £10 million loan fee, which is a lot, but for a player with 6 months left in his contract, but why not?
Absolutely. Premier League clubs must prove at least four positive coronavirus cases within their squad before attempting to delay a fixture. It's been announced. The laws on COVID postponements have been tightened. It confirmed it would be scrapping with immediate effect the requirement for fans to show a negative test or proof of vaccination to enter a stadium. This follows the government's decision to end Plan B COVID restrictions on movements. A couple of questions. Jack says, does anyone else automatically repeat any word that Wilson says which has a T in it? He's very insightful, but I have a three-year-old who I'm trying to get to pronounce her T's, and it has become instinct now. Perhaps he could say the rhyme, Betty bought a bit of butter.
Do I overpronounce or underpronounce my T's? What's he saying? I don't understand.
Well, I think he's saying, I'm guessing under, but I don't know. Could you give it a go?
Betty bought a bit of butter.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Louis says, with Chelsea looking into whether John Terry's used their intellectual property when making baby monkey NFTs, when is the pod going to get in on the pyramid scheme and do an NFT of Barry and Wilson monkeys on a Christmas bench? Well, we have recorded a cryptocurrency NFT special, Barry. You were there for all of it.
I was. I think I spoke twice in an hour and a half.
Anyway, that's coming out on Monday, and we hope it will give some insight. But we are yet to release any Football Weekly NFTs. And we're going to finish with a musical number. maybe I should say goodbye to the panelists first. So I will say goodbye and thank you very much to everybody. And then I will play out with this music. It's Dane says, "Hi Pod, further to recent discussions about the cross-section of Football Weekly listeners and metalheads, I just wanted to let you know that not only do metal fans listen to your excellent pod, but metal bands do as well. I've been a listener since 2015. I play in a black metal band, Sacred Sun, who gained notoriety for our decidedly un-metal album covers. If we ever play Brixton Academy, there'll always be a place for Barry in the mosh pit. Keep up the great work. Dane." So we got in touch with Dane and asked him if he would record a black metal version of the theme tune to Guardian Football Weekly. And he has done just that. So we'll play out with what I will describe as a really good and quite noisy version of the Football Weekly theme. In the meantime, Barry, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Cheers, Wilson.
Cheers, thank you.
Solis, thanks so much for coming on. I hope you'll enjoyed it enough to come back on again soon.
Yeah, sure. It's a real pleasure. Thanks, Max.
Good man. We'll be back on Monday with the crypto special.
This is The Guardian.